gonna touch my skill. You gotta go to one killer bee, and he ain't gonna kill now. Chop that. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that Shimmy Shimmy Ya by ODB on this day in 1998. ODB rushed the stage of the Grammys, disrupting Sean Colvin's acceptance speech, declared that Wu-Tang Clan should have won the Rap Album of the Year instead of Puff Daddy because Wu-Tang is for the children. So there we go. And the wars continue. And as they should. So we are going to we're going to talk, as we do often in this program, about what the future of the city is going to be and how it's going to be structured. There were two really interesting reports that came out recently that I was aware of, that also saw them in the Baltimore Brew just the other week, which maybe it was this week, that they came out with this. And these two reports that are interesting when you juxtapose them to one another. There was a report that came out of the City Observatory in Oregon that said that there's been an exponential rise in the number of millennials. And what does that mean? I'm not sure what millennials mean, but we'll talk about that in a minute, because there are a couple millennials in the room, and they we'll talk about what that means, but that the 25 to 30-year-olds are moving to Baltimore in droves, they have 25,000 quote-unquote educated millennials who live in communities around the harbor, up from 13,000 in the year 2010. But then there was another report that came out called Lost in Place that looked at 1,100 tracks in the metropolitan area of Baltimore from 1970 to 2010 and showed that there was this huge growth in people who lived in poverty in this city. That census tracks, whether you were 30%, now is 35% or more after 40 years. And then you see certain neighborhoods that have poverty has dropped, and let's guess where that neighborhood is. All right? It was around Johns Hopkins Hospital, where in 1970, 43% of the residents lived in what was called poverty, which means more than people lived in poverty, because that's an ancient definition from 1960s. And down to now 13% of the people in that community live in poverty. You look at the west side of our town, where I lived for most of my life, around Grins Falls Park and near that area in Rosemont, it has grown exponentially from 15% in 1970 to 42% in 2010. And I would bet you a dollar to a donut that after you look at it even further, that some of that is because people have been pushed into poverty by this economy. The other part is these are refugees from the areas that were developed and moved into more familiar African-American communities that are on the west side of town. You can also see those are the same zip codes where people do not have jobs and where crime and violence are peaking. So we think about that in terms of where we are today in Baltimore with the development of Station North. Station North Arts District. Do I get that right, Ben?
Close enough. Station North Arts and Entertainment District. Thank you.
And so we see it there. We see it what's happening in the East Oliver community that is now called the East Oliver community. But for all my life growing up in Baltimore, it was called Greenmount West. And whenever we seem to change neighborhood, we want to change the names of the neighborhood as well to make it sound nicer. East Oliver, not Greenmount West. Or we want to change Picktown's name and call it something else because Picktown doesn't fit. Or South Baltimore, South Baltimore, now it's Federal Hill, which used to be just the park. But at any rate, these neighborhoods are moving and changing. But what does that mean? And what is our vision about how this can happen and should develop? Is it so bad that people are moving in, millennials, and having gentrification in our society in Baltimore and uplifting neighborhoods? In terms of the housing stock. But what about the folks who are there now? Would do we think anyway creatively about how to make that work or how to keep it priced so that artists, black, white, and everybody else can actually afford to live there? Well, so let's wrestle with this. We have with us in the studio Ben Stone, who's executive director of the Station North Arts and Entertainment, Inc. Good to have you back here, Ben.
Thanks.
Jeff Singer's back in the house, founder and former executive director of the Healthcare for the Homeless, and continues being an advocate for housing and homeless and poverty in the city. Not for poverty, but to end poverty, I should say.
An honor, Mark.
Good to have you here. Lena Yone joins us for the first time in the studio. She's president of the Greenmount West Association. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Mia Loving's back in the house. Her sister was here just yesterday. We have this family in here a lot. Curator and founder of the Invisible Majority, a creative community incubator. Good to have you back, Mia.
Thank you.
And John Duda, who's a worker owner at Red Emma's, communication coordinator for the Democracy Collaborative and a founding board member of the Baltimore Activity Solidarity Economy. It's good to have you in the studio, John.
Thanks, Mark.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Email us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages, which I'll try to check out here, 410-319-8888. So we look at this. I'm curious what this says to us about where we're going and the complexity of where we're going here. You know, I am one who will, you know, go hangs out at Red Emma's. I'll have a beer at Liam's, or, you know, but I also hang out on the West Side. And this things are like really, really very different. And so what are we saying about where we're going and how we're thinking about getting there? Who wants to jump in first? Ben Stone, you're leading one of these districts, so jump in.
Yeah, that's a big, broad question. Where to start with that? So I think the two reports you mentioned are really crucial, and there was a great report done in Governing magazine this month that we were just discussing before we came on the air. And the last decade, or 1990 to 2000, gentrification in Baltimore, and that's a tough word to really wrap our minds around. Maybe that's something we can talk about on the air today and how one actually defines that. But at least by their definition, it really only occurred in waterfront communities, and now it's extended basically due north up the Charles Street Corridor into northwest Baltimore, and a little bit in west Baltimore, a little bit in east Baltimore, and there's all kinds of explanations for that. And that's largely due to millennials moving into the city and millennials having a different kind of desire for the neighborhoods they want to live in. And as you brought up, there's some good opportunities along with that, and there's some challenges that come along with that and different cultures coming in. In some cases, suburban mentality and suburban desires for the ways in which people want to live in cities, which can be a bit of a conflict. But there's also great opportunity for having new people move into areas that were formerly mostly vacant, which Station North largely was.
And Mia, good to have you back here. Let me let you jump in here about your thoughts about how these things juxtapose and how we have to think about this and how we maybe have to plan and think differently about how we want this to happen.
He made a really good point about people coming with kind of suburban mentalities, and I think on a social cultural level, that's been one of the bigger challenges. So, for example, when I was growing up in West Baltimore, we might be on a stoop. We would have like a car or a radio playing loud music. But what I found from people who grew up in the suburbs, outside spaces or like space should be quiet. You know, so if I'm moving into that neighborhood where there's a lot of young kids dancing or, you know, playing loud music, then my first thing is to maybe call for a complaint, you know. And so the difference comes in, like, let's say if I were to move to the suburbs, I would get like a huge welcoming committee telling me how I should assimilate or how I should integrate to make sure that I fit the standards of this living community. When it's the opposite, what's happening is populations are coming in and saying, this is how you should be and how you should act. And that's kind of where the conflict is. But beyond that, you know, it's like, If a tax bracket goes up, then people are, you know, become taxed out. You know, they feel an increased pressure from policing. It's certain, like, messages that are being sent out from communities who maybe have been fighting for a supermarket for 20 years, and then their needs aren't met, but you have an organization or a group that comes in, and within like 5 years, they're able to get their demands met. So, you know, this is where the tension is created. But I'm in agreement that there's certainly some positives, and it's certainly something that should have energy and attention to. The only thing I also want to say is, like, we keep talking as if it started at vacancy, when that's something that was like created and developed. There was intentional divestment, and when we look at the vacancy, we're not looking at what is there and what was there. And so then you have complaints about, like, well, what were you doing, or what were these communities doing, or what was there? And there was something there, and that should be respected, appreciated, and collaborated with, versus, like, you know, forced almost.
Leah, talk a bit about what your thoughts are living in Greenmount West.
I've been there for 11 years, and when I first moved there, there was a lot of just vacancy. It was 43% vacant, and then if you include the vacant land of the demolished buildings in that, it was around 60%. So what we're trying to do, the community association is trying to do, is focus on smart development. and assisting legacy residents that have been there, because those are the people that really supported me when I came to the community. You know, it's very close knit.
So I mean, I guess I still want to think about, when we think about what we're doing here in Baltimore right now, and what we're talking about developing, whether it's a station North Arts or whether it's in the Greenmount West and East Oliver communities, or what's happening now on Howard Street, or what people are looking forward to on around Lexington Market. How do we have to do this? Is there a way to do this way differently? Do we have a chance of taking what you're running, Station North Arts, and make it into a model community that is racially mixed, mixed by income, artists and other families, retired people and disabled people who live in the housing there, living together? Is that possible? Or is this just all a dream and development is just controlled by wealth and this the nature of the existence and that's what's going to be? We're not going to change the way it is. I mean, what can we do that's different?
It's a constant fight. We constantly have to be on top of it. The housing department, developers, we have a development committee that's very committed to working with residents, existing residents, but also with developers. We vet them very. It's a very rigorous process.
I mean, I think
Go ahead, John.
That we can't assume that just because we do economic development, we're going to get magical effects that are going to be inclusive and good for everybody. I think we need to think about being intentional when we're thinking about economic development. And if our end goal is to have participatory processes that bring everybody to the table, if our end goal is economic inclusion that breaks down some of the tremendous economic inequalities in the city that run primarily along race lines, then we need to build those into what we're doing. And to think that we can just have these engines of development in general that will be good for the city is, I think, a really mistaken idea.
So what is an idea that's not mistaken from your perspective, Jeff Singer?
Excuse me. From a micro and meso social and political economic perspective, we can do things somewhat differently. But from a macro social and political economic perspective, it won't make a big difference because they're forces that are driving the capital's investments. Capital has to turn over constantly. And the way it does that is by intentionally creating hollowed out areas in the city, which then become ripe for investment. It happened in the Inner Harbor. It happens all over the country. It happens in every city in the world. Mm-hmm. That's the way capital works. I think I'd like to paraphrase a guy named Marx who said, he was talking about religion.
Groucho?
Yeah, Groucho. He was talking about religion, but it could have been about gentrification. A gentrification are the flowers on the chains of our oppression. The point isn't to get rid of the flowers. We all like gentrified areas. I like to go to Station North. It's really nice to walk around there and go to Red Emma's and get a cup of coffee. But the point isn't to get rid of gentrification. It's to gentrify the entire world so everyone can live that kind of life.
So how much of that discussion takes place, do you think, Ben Stone, in our world? And how do you envision that happening in places like Station North?
Well, in my world, which is Station North these days, I think the advantage we have, and it's true in most places in Baltimore, things move rather slowly here. And go back to this report that I've been reading. Compared to a place like D.C. or New York or Boston, I think the way in which we develop is actually not always intentional, but it is often rather slow. I mean, there's so many places in the city you can hear about plans for development that have been in the works for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and nothing's actually happened yet. Mm-hmm. Anytime you see a building go under development in Station North, there's been discussion for at least 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And the opportunity that presents is that there's not a week to get people together and organize them and have them become participants in the process, but there's often 10 years to have them become participants in the process. And that's the real advantage we have over other places.
Let me open the phones here and get our listeners in to see what they're thinking at 410-319-8888. The Reverend Donald Washington from Aberdeen, welcome.
Welcome, Mark. I'm with this at working out, and I thought I would take time to to call in on the show.
Good.
Good morning, panelists. I think that we ought to, as a city of Baltimore community, so to speak, we ought to be buying up property and with the incentive of where we used to do it in the 60s, we used to have co-ops. And the whole neighborhoods used to have co-ops in Brooklyn and Manhattan and all New And I don't know if it happened down here yet, but when I moved down here, wasn't none of that happening. So I think that the neighborhood's got to aggressively take charge. And as a community organization in Northwood, before I moved out here, that they wouldn't even patrol their own communities. I mean, I'm serious. And that's one of the reasons why I moved out, because I was going to live in no community where the black captains and the administrative community or organizers in the upper structure of the community or organization wouldn't patrol in our own neighborhood. We had a rape in our community right on Woodbourne Avenue, and the guys act like they were scared of them. I mean, right. I come from a place where we control our community, and we told the police, no, don't go here, go there. So until we become lobbyists and take over Washington and stop being so doggone scared, I see a dim hope for Maryland and Baltimore in particular, because the state and the feds run everything here. And I'm going to cut off with saying this, that if more of us became lobbyists on a real sense and stopped going to them with our head in our hands, and they knew that we become lobbyists instead of corporations, that's the way the real change takes place. It's not Trump, it's us. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Reverend Donald Washington. Thanks for calling in, and enjoy your workout. I think that one of the things Donald was saying, Reverend Washington was saying here, is interesting to contemplate. I was at a meeting the other day in Station North Arts at MICA, and it revolved around people putting together this new economy conference coming to Baltimore, and the idea being that maybe there's a different way of thinking about building an economy in Baltimore. And one of the things that Donald Washington talked about just now calling in was this notion of co-ops, and whether it's co-op housing, people buying, tenants buying, getting the right to have buildings and having public money invested in those buildings so they could have co-op apartments, and people kind of controlling their own communities. Your sister Sasha was on here yesterday, Mia, talking about the idea in Park Heights, which is also fighting development in from the lower Park Heights because it's so close to the train station, but that the idea of building agricultural co-ops that actually give people work and change the nation community from that way. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. How do we think about this in ways that's not the same paradigm that we play out in every development in Baltimore?
One thing that I think would be great, and it's related to co-ops, which is a way to have community ownership of property, is community land trusts. And I know there's been a lot of energy around that in Baltimore recently. And the basic idea is you partially decommodify housing. You take housing out of the market to an extent that makes it possible to keep it permanently affordable. And, you know, a lot of people are worried about gentrification in Station North. And I think one thing that would be really exciting to see is some of these big nonprofit organizations that are throwing a lot of money and making a lot of investments in the area to also be making long-term investments in helping the community keep housing permanently affordable.
And I want to go back to Mia, but on the way there, I mean, so you know, I wonder when you think about where Station North Arts is going, because I think it really has such potential to be the thing that we're people are thinking about here in the city. Mm-hmm. How do you see that fitting in to that model?
You're looking at me, so I guess you were looking for an answer from me.
No, I was asking you. How do you see that fitting in as a model, as part of a development model for a place like Station North Arts?
I think it's a great idea. We have at least one co-op I know of. The Quirk Factory is one that artists bought actually just before Station North was designated. They're now there. They won't be priced out. They have ownership in the building, and it's a fantastic model. It's not an easy thing to pull off, which is why you don't see
replicated. Why is it so hard to pull off, do you think?
Building has to be affordable. If you are a group of, in that case, I don't even know, a dozen artists or so, buying a building, and the building is millions and millions of dollars. The average artist's income in the United States is something like $25,000, $26,000. So you're probably not in a position to easily purchase a building. So you need to find some sort of gap financing or grant funding to make that happen. There's lots of discussions about that now, but it hasn't happened yet. But I would love to see more of it.
So how do we make that happen? I mean, and I do know the Quirk Factory. I have friends who live there. Mm-hmm. My friend who passed away, Dennis Livingston, lived there. Right. A bunch of other folks I know live in that building. And these are people who are also, for want of a better term, kind of radical community artist activists in this community, always have been. So how do we make that happen? What is it? What is an economic structure?
I mean, I'll give an example of kind of what's happening now. Because one of the issues that we're seeing is, again, people were fighting for certain things for 30, 40 years, having these conversations about co-ops, about, like, home ownership, about all of these things. And then when things are starting to come into fruition, again, it's people who are recently moving in that's being able to benefit from them more. And so an example is like the Vacants to Value initiative. And I went to the first meetings. This is something I was excited about. I'm fresh out of college. I went to school in Philly. I'm coming back to Baltimore. I'm like, yo, I'm about to get me a house. Like, it's something, you know, I'm getting some land. It's like $1,000 houses. They're giving away for $1 or something, you know. And but then you looked at the actual requirements. You had to have at least an 800 credit score, at least $8,000 in the bank. And a couple of other things, and it's kind of like that's not necessarily doable for a lot of people, and especially a lot of people from here. And then you get from the opposite, well, you should have been more responsible, or you should have been more this. But the reality in this city, you have people whose parents have used their name to get gas and electric to keep the lights on because their credit was so messed up. So people are graduating high school already with bad credit. Credit has been used to maintain the status quo and not give more people opportunities. Or again, I talked to someone from Healthy Neighborhoods when I first moved in. I said, why not also a part of your marketing strategy, market to people like me who are from here but live somewhere else and are coming back and are trying to establish themselves as adults, you know, versus putting all of this money into trying to convince people that have never looked twice at Baltimore to come in. This is a way to quicken the process. It's so slow because we're trying to convince people who could care less to care, you know? So development always takes 10, 15, 20 years, yes. But it could be a little bit more quicker if we're a little bit smarter about it, you know? People who are living at home with their parents who are 25 years old, this is a common place here right now, not only in Baltimore, but the United States. And if I'm working with these people who are working, and get them into a situation or work with them to get, an abandoned or create, you know, help create these opportunities for everybody, that would attract everyone. It would be a little bit more equitable. Like, these are basic things that's already happening, could just be done a little bit better.
I mean, I think when we argue about when we hear that millennials are moving in and people are moving in the city, and you can really feel it in certain communities. You can really feel it in the below the harbor and the east side. You can feel this then see the younger group coming in. But you're also a millennial.
Yes.
Right?
I guess. Yeah, right? I'm reading this word.
Right. So I mean, your age group, that's who you are.
Yeah.
By the way, how it's classified.
Mm-hmm.
But I always get the sense that when we talk about millennials in Baltimore, we're not talking about Mia Loving.
Not quite.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, why not?
Because we're talking about mostly young white professionals coming to Baltimore.
Who is?
You don't think that's the subtext when we talk about what millennial means?
Well, sure. There's income disparity between races. So if you, draw from that, then certainly, yeah. And if you're talking about people who have the choice to choose where they want to live, then it's majority white people in the United States.
Right.
Right.
So what I'm saying is...
That doesn't exclude people who have the income and have the capacity to make that choice who are not white.
And what about people who don't, though?
Well, they're probably not choosing to move into a gentrifying neighborhood because they're not able to.
I agree. So, I mean, that's the paradigm I'm trying to figure out. How do you change? How do you? You know, when people talk about, like, my friend of mine who couldn't come on today, was hoping he would join us, Dan Henson, who used to be the housing commissioner of Baltimore, and is a developer, I've known Dan since we were teenagers, He, when we talk about developing Baltimore, and he talks about mixed income neighborhoods. I mean, how do you really define what mixed income means, and how do you really make that work?
Well, this is part of what I was referring to earlier on a particular individual neighborhood, Station North, McKeldry Park, where there is a community land trust, and there will be some affordable housing, I think, built there that won't be priced out for the people who live in the neighborhood. That's going to happen. It can happen in individual neighborhoods. But on the whole, for example, with the city, there is no city affordable housing plan. There has never been one. There is a city economic development plan, and it provides hundreds of millions of dollars to developers. I understand the fellow who developed Harbor Point, to whom we gave somewhere between $400 and $600 million.
Michael Beebe.
I understand that he owns a lot of property in Station North. And I'm not clear what will happen to it. But we do know that $600 million developing Harbor Point could make a big difference in other neighborhoods if it were democratically controlled.
Where do the people in McKeldry Park get the resources for a land trust and co-op?
Well, to establish the land trust, with the property values being so low, you can accumulate the property. To build it, that's an enormous problem. And the $400 to $600 million we put in that Harbor Point project could have helped build affordable housing that would never become out of reach of the people in the neighborhoods. But it's not available now. Now, we've talked about a citywide bond that would create $200 million for 2 years to put into affordable housing. And there will be some coming in from the National Housing Trust Fund monies. But all of that requires a completely different economic thrust and a completely different political thrust. Because Vacance to Values is a program designed not to create affordable housing. It's a program designed to bring in people with some money. That 800 units have been redeveloped through Vacance to Values, and as far as I know, not a single one is affordable to the 86,000 households in Baltimore who are poor.
So I guess that's what I'm trying to wrestle with here as we take a quick break, is how we develop that, how we make that Baltimore work for everyone. And I think it can. I am all for people moving in and buying vacants and investing and building homes and making and doing that. I think that it adds the vibrancy of the city. But the city also has a different vibrancy that has to be part of it as well. How do we get there? That's what I really want. That's what I'm honing in on. Not that it's terrible that this is happening, but that how do we make it better? So we'll come right back to that. And to Will and the others calling in at 410-319-8888. And on our way to break here, remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Of course, what you're hearing right now is signed, sealed, and delivered by Stevie Wonder. On this day in 2009, Barack Obama honored Stevie Wonder with the Library of Congress's Gershwin Prize, the country's highest award for pop music, and signed, sealed, and delivered was one of the songs that Obama's campaign used during his run for office. And we are here looking at the question of development in our community with some really interesting people. Ben Stone is the executive director of the Station North Arts Entertainment District. Mia Loving is curator and founder of Invisible Majority, a creative community incubator. Lena Leone is president of the Greenmount West Association. Jeff Singer, former founder and former executive director of healthcare for the homeless. And John Duda is worker owner at Red Emma's. In Station North Arts, 410-319-8888 is the number here. Before we go to Will, our next caller up, I want to pick up what people missed inside this conversation taking place during the break. And who wants to lead off? Do you want to start me, and then we'll go over to Ben, and everybody can jump in?
You know, we were just talking about, like, a lot of times when we have this conversation, it's kind of like white equal money, black equal no money. And when they, you know, when they come in, they're putting their money and resources in, and it's pricing out and all of that, but it's a lot more complex than that. One of the reasons why we're seeing reports of more millennials coming in, but not necessarily increased income, because, you know, I graduated college 2009. This was like the beginning of the so-called economic destruction. So my friends who went to better schools than me, who had 4.0s, that went to Georgetown and New School and all of that, they're coming out and working at restaurants, you know. Like, I had a decent job, but most of the people in my circle didn't necessarily. And so, you know, So that's one thing. You're seeing a new face of poverty, and one of the reasons why we're even having this these conversations, because these 25 and 30, they might still be living home. If they're not living home, they're still subsidized by their parents. They might be getting government assistance. They're partially employed. They're underemployed. But when they are white, whiteness in and of itself brings attention or more like higher taxes or whatever because of the history of redlining. And what we associate, the fact that even when we're thinking like, oh, all of these resources are coming in, when that's not necessarily true. There's a increased energy for sure. There's an increase like mental, all that. And even when we look at an area like Station North, again, we looked at mostly the abandonment without always thinking about how it got there. But we weren't thinking about what was already there. And what was already there was a theater, clubs. And right now, these places are being starved out. They've been intentionally pushed out. And I'm not saying, it's a complicated who that is that's doing it. I'm not going to put it on like one group or one organization. There's been a lot of pieces involved to get certain businesses, not just people, out. These are people that have money. These are people who attracted an audience into the area when nobody cared about it. And they've been told they don't belong there anymore, these are the things that are happening. Baltimore, another report showed that Baltimore is in the top 10 for black-owned businesses. When development comes into the city, if there is a mandate on so-called minorities to be involved, it's 25% in the city. That's 60%, and that's supposed to be the best for black-owned businesses, but it only has to be 20-25%, That's what happened with the race car thing came in. That was the mandate. And so that's the thing that's been challenging for me here. In other areas where it really is black, white, poor, rich, but here where you have like a huge black middle class surrounding inside the city, black business owners, we can have economic development by if we're going to make it a class thing and we just want people with money to come, we can have that be racially diverse in Maryland because Maryland is the place for that,
That's it. Ben Stone.
There's a lot to say about that. During the break, I was talking about how I feel like during these discussions, we often leave out focusing on the black middle class, and something that I'm personally very interested in trying to attract to Station North. And there's a lot of black middle class folks who do own businesses and are developers in Station North and come to Station North on a regular basis. And part of the issue maybe is that we're not focusing attention on them, and that's something we should all start to do a better job of. And I always carry this book around with me discussion. This is Lance Freeman's There Goes the Hood, and there's a lot of really great points in there, one of which is that, at least in New York, which is what this book focuses on, when neighborhoods were being gentrified, it was often black middle-class folks moving into those neighborhoods, and the white power structure basically ignored them and didn't notice them, frankly. And when white residents moved in after them, after the black middle class had done the hard work without city support and without other kinds of support, then people started noticing, and then support started coming. And I wonder if there are neighborhoods in Baltimore where that's the case as well.
And there are. Like Reservoir Hill, we were talking about one of those neighborhoods was Reservoir Hill, where that was very clear-cut. That very clearly happened. So I'm going to turn to two other two guests here for a moment because you both, I don't know where you live, John, but but where you work, at least where the worker-owned business is, Red Emma's, and where you live, Lena, are two of the neighborhoods we're talking about. So how do you envision the neighborhoods you're in being different than the prescribed model we're always expecting because of the conditions of both Ben and Mia have outlined?
Well, from my perspective, I think we need to think about displacement in Station North. And if we focus just on gentrification, we focus on a very specific narrative that people have in their heads that involves hipsters and property values. And it's an important narrative, but it misses a lot of what's actually going on. And we need to think about how do we make space for low-income residents who, for instance, until recently were depending on a public housing project, which is now being privatized. How do we make space for people who are dealing with addiction and who have an entire community in the neighborhood around access to clinical services, which a number of the actors in Station North are now trying to, you know, push out at any cost as like this horrible existential threat. Red Emma's is right on the corner where most people who are going to the methadone clinics, you know, are waiting for the bus. We have absolutely no problems with this, and we keep getting people keep trying to recruit us to do this, you know, please help us fight the scourge of, you know, people with addiction problems. We're like, well, no, actually, we think we should think about harm reduction instead. So I think we need to think very holistically about displacement and about, you know, what's at stake and what the dynamics are. And then I also think we need to be, you know, imaginative about what we want to see there. I mean, I would love to see, and I think this goes to what Mia was saying, like more Black cultural institutions in Station North. It's been a center for Black culture, you know, in many different times during its history. There's no reason why it couldn't be again. And I think seeing more spaces there rather than trying to, you know, I mean, definitely some of the spaces have been tried to be pushed out. But I know Mia has opened a space up at 25th Street in Charles. That's really exciting. Seeing more stuff like that happening in the vicinity and really building an actual multiracial cultural environment that the whole city can really be excited about, especially given its location. I mean, it's right in the middle of, you know, where East meets West, where North meets South. It's right in the crossroads of all of Baltimore. And I think we need to be intentional and ambitious about making this into a space that everybody can really feel excited about being in.
It's the intentionality, and it's how you plan with that intentionality, I think, is at the bottom of this. What were you going to say, Leah?
So in Greenmount West, there's low-income housing that has a 20-year lease on it. And it's challenging when you're dealing with the middle-class residents that have been there, African-American residents that have been there since the 50s. The houses are 100 years old. And some of them a lot of people don't know this, but the issue is they can't get insurance on their houses and therefore they can't get loans to
fix
them up.
Because the vacants around them.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. So that's something one of the challenges that we're dealing with in our neighborhood, and we're looking to find creative ways to come up with, you know, ideas to solve that.
One of the things that Bob Kaufman, who is a curmudgeon in many ways, used to know forever, but he was a community fixture here. He, for years, was trying to start a cooperative insurance agency that would cover automobiles because insurance rates are so high in Baltimore, which was a great idea and almost got to fruition, but then people got scared of it in government and didn't back the idea to make it happen. That same idea could work when it comes to home insurance for Baltimore as a co-op to insure people's homes and also figure out a way for low income, for middle class families, as you're talking about, Leah, that could then borrow at some low interest loans backed by the city to allow them to rehab their own houses to keep living in decent conditions. I mean, there are all kinds of creative ways to do this, but I think what we have to do is push power structures in town to start thinking of different ways of doing these things. I think, you know, you've got creative people like Ben Stone at the head of Station North, and if you bring that energy together with others, that kind of stuff I think can happen. But let me go to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Will, you're on the air.
Good morning.
I know that voice. Will Hanna, how are you?
I'm good. This is Will Hanna. I'm the president of the New Park Heights Community Development Corporation. And, you know, one thing that we've done, and we talked about I heard you all talk about the affordable housing needs. And I believe John Duda's there.
Yep. Hey, Will.
Hey, John, how you doing?
Good.
And I'm familiar with Ben and quite a few people in there as well. Hey, Ben. What we did is we created an affordable housing community land trust in Park Heights initially, and now just got beginning in the implementation stages of it and seeing how the home ownership piece of it works. So what we did is that what people miss in the land trust concept is the ability to incentivize the deals on the front end to investors and developers, and that's what we've done. So there's a full fair market value tax deduction that we can issue directly from the trust to the investors. That's how you spread the investors. That's how you get the development dollars to go into neighborhoods. And that's what we're doing in Park Heights. So there's another side of it that allows you to work with the banks, with the REOs, with their foreclosed property. All of these communities in Baltimore have foreclosed properties in them that the banks own. So in the land trust concept, we actually acquired those properties, which we just got our first fee from Wells Fargo. And so in that, now we're providing affordable housing in the neighborhood of between 80 and 110,000. We just sold the first property in Park Heights at 119, which is comparable to the properties that are being sold for 160 to 180 in that same neighborhood. That's how you begin to spur that type of process. So that can be done anywhere in the city, but there's also a commercial component to it. So as we talk about what's going on in Station North, we are now right now, and we've been doing this for 2 years, and Ben and I have been talking about this for 2 years in the development project on North Avenue, the former Odell site. So we just restructured that deal. Ben, I'll talk to you about that offline. But we just restructured that deal because there is a commercial component to what you can do with a land concept and doing mixed-use development. So there's a whole lot of things around that, and I wish we had more time that we could literally focus on what that concept is. Not only did we create this land trust in Park Heights, because we got so much interest from other community development corporations across the city, we created the Baltimore City Affordable Housing Community Land Trust. So there is a citywide initiative to do this, and there are some people coming together to make this work, and I would love to have the opportunity to speak with people in studio offline as well.
All right. Well, always good to hear from you, and maybe we'll have to get you on the air to kind of take discussion and look at that in a deeper way. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner. Two quick thoughts and then a question, please. Mm-hmm. I always envisioned black culture as the arena players moving into the Moss Mechanic, but that's not ever going to happen.
That's going to happen. It's gone now.
Yeah. When you speak about black-owned businesses in the city, would you consider looking at them in a sense of mainstream and non-mainstream black-owned businesses? And just to, you know, put a label or a category in that, black-owned businesses that are selling, that have products and goods or services that are earning $100,000 a year or more and are part of the mainstream, where they not only black people are going there, but the multitude of the city is frequenting in those businesses, as opposed to just the small-owned black-owned businesses off to the side somewhere, you know, predominantly in a black community. Where does that fit into the scheme of things? Thank you.
You want to rest with that? I'm trying to. I meant to ask Clarence to clarify a bit more what he was describing, but I'm not quite sure. Anybody have a thought?
I'm not sure exactly, but I know that what is it, the Black Chamber of Commerce, I can't remember the exact name, and I feel bad that I put that, but they meet weekly, and they've been advocating to make sure that there's, you know, fair development, or that, you know, when a big project or developer comes into town, that those major businesses are being engaged. For those who are, you know, working on development, maybe, you know, you can speak on how they're being used. But the mainstream thing just kind of like, because when I went to the Mayor's Arts and Culture Town Hall and I asked her about, like, how are we going to be fair and equitable in this community development and in creative placemaking, that was the response that I got. I think you're talking about underground and we're talking about mainstream. And that was really difficult for me to understand what that meant, especially when the main presentation was talking about what was happening in Station North and what was happening in Highlandtown, and neither of these things are super mainstream to me. You know, that is the community that I live and work, you know, and what we're doing is helping bring color to the neighborhood, and so we're called, you know, so is that underground? Is that, I'm like, it's just all confusing, and why does this matter in the context of black-owned businesses, but doesn't seem to matter in the context of white-owned businesses and white artists. I don't know.
That's an interesting point. I'm curious, Ben, how would you have responded to that if you heard the mayor say that? What was it that she said?
She said, I think you're talking, okay, so my question was, how do we make this development more equitable? And right. You know. And she said, I think you're talking about underground and we're talking about mainstream. And I just didn't have the time to address that.
I don't know exactly what the mayor was talking about, so I won't necessarily comment on that, even though I was there. But I do think it is easier for so-called underground arts organizations that are white-run to emerge from the underground than it is for black-run businesses or black-run arts organizations. And I think that's where intentionality comes into play. And I think GVCA and the Urban Arts Leadership Program, I know some of those fellows have been on the air previously, the benefits of that program will start to hopefully become apparent in the next several years. But it's really about making a conscious choice to help people who want to be emerging from the underground, regardless of who's leading those organizations, or even being intentional about singling out the black-owned businesses and black-owned arts organizations and helping them as well, because white-run organizations certainly have a leg up in the city and across the country.
So, again, folks, 410-319-8888, and I guess that's been part of the theme of this part of the discussion today is how we change that dynamic in the city and what is the kind of capital and resources have to be developed in a town like this to change that reality. I mean, that's what I really – I mean, if there's anything I'm obsessed with when it comes to whether it's the work we're doing in Station with Arts or the work that's being done on Howard Street, you know, or the work that's going to be done in Lexington Market, is that question.
I want to say, I think first we got to change the way that we have these discussions, and I'm already seeing that happening. But, the way that we talk about cities in America is all the black people started moving in, all the white people started moving out. It was terrible for 40 years, so we got to get them back in so that it can be cool again. And, you know, that's really unfair, and it's unfair to me as somebody that went to school and learning this narrative or teaching kids, and we're walking around doing a tour. This was so great when white people lived here, and now that you're here, it's awful. And when we do that and we start to teach a more real history. Like when I was listening to Eddie Conway, and he was saying, you know, he was in jail for 40 years. He's coming out to Baltimore looking at all these vacant houses because the neighborhood he grew up in didn't look like that. This was a black neighborhood. I want to know more of those stories so that I'm not being a part of the washing me out or being a part of putting me out there. And we are appreciating what was already there. That the Micah building that's right there in North Avenue and Maryland Avenue, it was Morgan, you know. What's her name? Zora Neale Hurston went there, you know, when it was a high school. These are the things that we need to put out and we need to know, and we need to still have something on there that has a plaque that says, this was Morgan. Some key historical figures have come through here. So at least, you know, D.C. is like awful in how, but D.C., at least you can walk through the neighborhoods that they push people out and still see that W.E.B. Du Bois was once walking down this street, or you know, there's no appreciation for culture here, period. We have a very low self-esteem as a city. We have to raise our self-esteem.
So we only have a few minutes left here, and I do you want to jump in and say something real fast?
Greenmount West is one of those neighborhoods. Like, I have neighbors from the 50s that talk about how great the neighborhood was and how it didn't have a lot of crime, and that's what we want to get back to. It's about safety for everyone, and it's predominantly the drug markets that moved in and took over, and that's what we're trying to combat.
I want to say it was partially corporations divesting in these neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. It's not all about people,
right?
Individuals.
Let me get a couple of callers last minute here and get some final thoughts. 410-319-8888. Hank, you're on the air.
Hey, Mr. Stein.
Welcome, Hank.
How are you feeling today, young man? And Jeff?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. It is this, right? If we self-taught each other about our history, right, that, one, we would have greater respect for where we come from, right? Like, I teach my kids that where I grew up on Bond and Preston, around the corner of as George Washington Carver lived on Spring Street or Dallas Street, right? I tell my kids how black people once owned stores, the black lady, Miss Cash, like right now, I got a store, right? And I tell these guys in my neighborhood, look, yo, anytime you're ready to get up off this corner, I got all of these little things, right? I'm not going to give you everything. You bring a piece. You got a piece of my store where you can work out of to do something legitimate. We're not doing that, right, at all. Nobody's offering anybody a leg up, a hand up. It's all for yourself, and you ain't teaching or telling nobody nothing. my kids can go back and tell them where my grandfather come from and what my grandfather did. So they have a better respect for life and understanding, right? If my kids sit down and watch documentaries, so they have a better understanding of self-worth, right? Then therefore, if you can build a better business when you know who you are and which you come from. I'm from Greenmount, right? And my kids are proud to say that they're from Greenmount Avenue. And if I got my way, I got a whole block of Greenmount Avenue that I'm going to build up in the black stores, right? But here's the thing. I don't want them to service just blacks. I want them to service all people. Because there's where we go wrong at, just trying to service ourselves.
Let me try to get a color cup. Before you hang up, man, where is your new store?
It's right there. You know where they shot the movie The House of Cards at on Greenmount Avenue?
No.
2601 Greenmount Avenue.
I'm coming by.
Hey, Mark, give me a little bit. I've been trying to get you down. I've been emailing you, talking to you. Let me get my organic fish system set up, and I got something that's going to rock your sock.
All right, let me know, man. I'm coming down. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Sam. A quick thought here before we have to go to break and thank our guests for coming in here today.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to say that in 2000, I noticed when I did the centennial census for the neighborhood in Whitelock and a Brookfield community, that a lot of those houses, a lot of those big three-story houses were lost to the children of the owners that passed away because they didn't give them the information that they needed about paying taxes and keeping the ground rent paid on these houses. And as a result, a lot of people lost their property because they thought the houses were paid for and they didn't owe anything. Hmm. And then the taxes came in, and year after year became, you know, it added up, and then they weren't able to pay them, and they lost it. So out of ignorance, you know, unknowing, this is what happened to that particular community. I know that for a fact.
Sam, that's a really interesting story. I'd like to make a producer and get your name and number. We'd like to hear more about that story before we conclude today. That's a really interesting piece of this. What are you going to say, Ben? Are you going to say something?
Not about that comment. It's about a final thought.
Well, we have a final thought from everybody here. Get one more call and do a final thought round robin here. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Hal in Baltimore.
How are you today?
Very well, Hal.
Thank you for taking the call. I believe that the entity the young lady was speaking about was the Greater Baltimore Black Business Chamber, and I am a member of that organization. And we try to engage developers when they come into Baltimore to make sure that minorities do get a fair shake. Does it always happen? I think we all know the answer to that. The other thing is that you were mentioning in that corridor along Howard Street, there's a gentleman down there, Mr. Bass, who has opened up an entity in that old bank that sits on Howard, and I believe it's Marbury. It's called the Downtown Culture Arts Center. And they allow people to come in and present plays
right.
and different things. I know you've been there because we've met down there.
Right,
once.
Right.
Yeah, and that's a well-kept secret in this town that entity exists. And I would think that if people have a real interest in presenting something, they could contact Mr. Bass, and he would be more than happy to entertain anything that they have going on there.
Hal, I'm glad you called, and we look forward to talking to you some more as well. I want to get your information so we can make sure that you are part of these roundtables when we have them on the future of business. Let's get some final thoughts around the room very quickly. We'll start with Ben Stone.
Two final thoughts very quickly. One, if I had a wish I could make, it would be to stop using the word pioneer when we talk about millennials moving back in the city. I think just starting with that would start to shift the way this conversation goes. So everyone out there can agree to do that. I think we'll be in good shape. And two, going back to the intentionality discussion, I think some of the programming that my organization does, and I'm the only full-time person working for it, so we're rather small in a neighborhood that has a lot of activity going on. We're not responsible for everything, certainly. But we are being as intentional as possible, and we are targeting organizations run by artists of color and black artists. And we love to do more of it, so I encourage people to reach out to me if they have ideas of things they'd like to do.
Well, that's interesting. I want to follow up on that. Leah Leone.
My final thought would be about an engagement. Having the voice of the community being at the table when these decisions are made. And I'm talking about engaging everyone. What we try to do when we do meetings is we do door knockers, flyers. We do email. We do next door social media for neighborhoods. It's really important to engage as many people from the community as possible.
Me loving.
Lord have mercy. It's just so much going through my mind. I would, because you're saying let's be solution oriented. What I guess I would like to see is everyone kind of coming together and going to these developer meetings and going to the city council and coming up, you know, sharing a plan that works and recognizing even if you're benefiting from these practices, you're being used as well, or you're not being fully benefited, you know. So let's all work together.
John Duda.
You know, I think that when we talk about gentrification, it's not the root of all evil in the modern city. It's one evil among many, and it's an evil that's particularly symptomatic of much larger inequalities. And I think we need to think big about dealing with those, and I think we need to start building the pipelines to get the alternative institutions we want to see, whether that's co-ops, community land trusts, whether that's getting capital into communities where they can do things to, you know, basically rebuild the places that they live without being displaced. We need to build that infrastructure. We need to build that ecosystem. It exists for traditional business development, so we need to build it for the kind of business development that we want to see.
Jeff Singer.
Thank you. Two dialectics come out of this discussion I think that we should focus on. One is the one between intentionality and structure. The political economy is what drives what's going on as much as what we want to do with it or with our neighborhoods. And secondly, race and class. My gosh, of the 33,238 households in Baltimore with incomes less than $10,000, right? None of them can afford the $80,000 houses in Park Heights. None of them could afford the rents anywhere in Baltimore, and we don't even have a plan for them. Race and class.
And that these are all very important things, and that, as we keep forgetting, that 86,000 families in Baltimore are housing insecure as we think about what we're doing in the city. Thank all of you for coming in today. It's been a pleasure to have this conversation with you all. We can take a very brief break, and all eyes on Annapolis with Dave on Love. Stay with us. We'll be right back.